Thank you for downloading Analysis from the BBC. Technology has been replacing manual work for decades. I'm David Baker, and in this programme, I'll be asking, does it now have white-collar jobs in its sights? I'm on the Docklands Light Railway in East London. Every weekday, a fleet of 48 of these trains ferry up to 44,000 commuters an hour, many of them travelling to and from the financial powerhouses of Canary Wharf. The system has minimal delays and a good safety record, and most noticeably, there are no drivers. These trains are operated by computers housed in a central control room. Technology has always destroyed jobs, as factory workers have known for decades, but it's also created new ones. There are very few typesetters in Britain today, for example, but plenty of website designers. Now, however, something different seems to be happening. Technology's become so good that, according to some researchers, it's destroying jobs, but not creating as many new ones. And the jobs that it now has in its sights are those done by the people you can hear hurrying to their offices around us now. Professional, white-collar workers whose careers may no longer be the one-way ticket to wealth and security. In this programme, I'll be exploring whether technology is different this time round and what the effect could be on the future of the world of work.
The scope and the pace and the scale of technological progress is pretty breathtaking to me.
Andrew McAfee is a researcher at the MIT Sloan School of Management and one of the authors of The Second Machine Age. His book has attracted huge attention and controversy by arguing that we're now going through a very different period of technological change than we've seen before.
There have been these periods of technological upheaval in the past. They were accompanied by a lot of job destruction, and then eventually people went back to work. Now, when I look at the range of human-like abilities that technology is suddenly demonstrating, I think this is different. I think that the comparative advantage of human beings in lots of different fields is vanishing very quickly, and I don't think we've seen this before. As technology races ahead, it's leaving behind more and more people in their capacity as somebody who wants to do their part of the classic bargain. I offer my labor, I get a good middle-class living in exchange. It's pretty clear that bargain is under a lot of pressure these days, and I believe tech progress is one of the main reasons why.
Others agree. Federico Pistono is a computer scientist and social activist, an author of Why Robots Will Steal Your Job. We'll hear about the subtitle of his book a little later in this programme.
What's happening now is radically different. We are essentially exchanging types of workers at the level of the cognitive abilities that only humans were supposed to have up until just a few years ago. So if in the past we kind of outsourced to machines manual labour, now we are outsourcing cognitive labour.
That cognitive labour is what those people we call professionals do now. And those professions were meant to promise us a secure future. Medicine, for example, or law. Andrew McAfee again.
None of us would have called what a doctor does routine work, but it is basically an exercise in pattern recognition. If I walk in with a problem, the doctor listens to my symptoms and she makes a diagnosis about what's going on with me. Now, that work requires an extraordinarily well-trained, very talented human being to do well. But cutting-edge software is better. It's superhuman at pattern recognition. And I look at medical diagnosis as a really subtle and important exercise in pattern recognition, but the technology is better at that than we are now.
And the law?
A lot of the work that a lawyer does, especially a more junior lawyer, a lot of that work can be automated. In America, we love to sue each other. And one of the initial steps in that process is I send you all of my documents, you send me all of your documents. And then in the old world, we would each hire an army of lawyers to sit around and read those, go through them. It's a process called discovery. Now, there's a class of software called e-discovery that just takes all the work that was done by that army of lawyers and automates it, lets you do it at the push of a button.
And what about my job? Could computers really write magazine articles or radio programs, for instance? Well, maybe not yet, but they're on their way. For 5 years now, a US company called Narrative Science has been producing journalism that's written entirely by computers and distributed automatically to websites, magazines and local papers, replacing the jobs of reporters. And you know what? It's not bad. These examples come from Forbes, which uses the service to get financial results quickly up online.
Revenue fell year over year in the third quarter, snapping the three-quarter streak of rising revenue. While being profitable for the last 8 quarters, the company
has seen a narrower loss than a year ago when it reports fourth quarter earnings on Monday, March 2nd, 2015. Analysts are expecting a loss of $2.04 per share.
The consensus earnings per share estimate has moved up from 68 cents a share to the current expectation of earnings of 74 cents a share.
The trouble is, lawyers, doctors, journalists, these are not professions we thought would be under threat from computing. Let's face it, there was some snobbery here. We could envisage factory work being done by robots, but law? And yet, according to Carl Frey and Michael Osborne, two academics at the Oxford Martin School, who've been researching this subject for some years now, within a couple of decades, computers could be doing more than a third of the jobs that British white-collar workers do right now. That's a lot of middle-class professionals trying to find alternative employment. So what does that leave for us humans to do? Journalists get a lot of time on the radio already. So let's hear from two practicing professionals, a lawyer and a doctor.
My name's Gregor Pryor. I'm a partner at the international law firm Reed Smith. The type of law I practice tends to be based around intellectual property. The effects of technology on law firms certainly means that less time is spent by lawyers on doing certain things. And it has almost certainly resulted in a reduction in the number of support staff around law firms. You don't need tens, hundreds of people doing administrative roles because computers have made that so much easier.
So bye-bye the secretarial pool. But what about their bosses?
Lawyers are seen as trusted counsel, and that it's partly through the advice they give, but it's also partly to do with their personality, their delivery, the way that lawyers can make clients feel more comfortable. Some lawyers would say, well, you wouldn't let a computer operate on you.
Of course you wouldn't. Well, actually, maybe we would.
There are already operations being performed by robots.
Benjamin Ellis is a consultant rheumatologist at Imperial College Healthcare NHS Trust in London.
Some parts of surgery are technical tasks that a computer with support and input from an experienced surgeon can perform better, perhaps, than that surgeon working on his or her own.
This is starting to happen in cancer surgery. Instead of operating directly on the patient, the surgeon uses a computer to control a robot arm. This can make much tinier and more accurate movements than a human. And it's not hard to imagine this process being automated entirely. Medical scans are just digital images, after all. And as Andrew McAfee has pointed out, computers are now very good at pattern recognition, which includes things like spotting cancerous tumours. So why not leave the robot to its own devices? Dr. Benjamin Ellis again.
I'm not sure at the moment that computers are capable of giving people the emotional support they need, and even if they could, I'm not sure that you would necessarily want a hug from a computer.
To be honest, I don't know if I'd want a hug from my doctor. I think I'd prefer a good diagnosis any day, but I can see his point. But do we really want hugs from lawyers, even in a metaphorical sense? Don't we want the law to be ruthlessly analytical? Katie Atkinson, a reader in computer science at the University of Liverpool, thinks artificial intelligence could do a lot of the thinking and advice we currently pay lawyers to do.
A lot of people, when they think about artificial intelligence, it's easy to think about the science fiction movies.
And as she goes on to explain, this isn't science fiction, this is happening now.
If you're in a court of law, the different sides, they exchange arguments, and what we try and do is we try and model the kind of argumentation that goes on in law.
She is currently working on software for a local law firm that will help its lawyers weigh up the pros and cons of a case before they proceed.
I envisage it as being a decision support tool, like I say, so perhaps something that could help legal analysts make sense of their arguments before they go to court, or anything where you're trying to get a handle on large volumes of data and information.
And in field tests, her programme seems to be delivering the goods.
So I've done some exercises with some colleagues where we have taken legal cases and we've seen how we can represent the arguments in those legal cases in terms of our formal theories. So we take specific legal cases, look at the transcripts that have been taken from the judge's opinion that the judges have delivered on the case. We've looked at the arguments for the plaintiff and the defendant, and then we've seen how those arguments fit into our formal reasoning models. And then we can press the button, if you like, and say go, and our programme will produce the same decision that the judge has produced in that case.
But why stop there? If computers can advise lawyers about the strength of their cases, why not use them in court? Lawyer Gregor Pryor is, perhaps understandably, resistant to the idea.
I'm not sure, at least dealing with the clients I deal with, that they would be comfortable with the idea, necessarily, that a computer would be the sole and definitive arbitrator and judge of their dispute. So for that to happen, for computers to totally dominate the dispute process, humans would need to be comfortable with that.
Yes, but as those typists found, a computer doesn't need to dominate a process to put a lot of people out of work. Woody Allen, in a clip from his third album, recorded live at Eugene's in San Francisco in 1968.
My father was fired. He was technologically unemployed. My father worked for the same firm for 12 years. They fired him. They replaced him with a tiny gadget this big. It does everything that my father does, only it does it much better. The depressing thing is my mother ran out and bought one.
Back then, the idea that technology could replace humans was something we could joke about. Economies were booming, and there was plenty of work, in the US at least, at all levels of society. Today, we seem to be in a different place, not only because of the recession, but also because the machines are getting better and better at a startling pace. 5 years ago, speech recognition technology was pretty hit and miss. Now there's the speech recognizing assistant Siri on the iPhone, and we can ring the local cinema and tell a computer the name of the film we want to see. But people are divided on the effect this will have on jobs. Maybe technologists are just getting overexcited, which is what technologists tend to do. And as the history of economics has shown us again and again, this time is different is a very dangerous statement to make. We put a number of these points to Gavin Kelly, CEO of the think tank The Resolution Foundation. He has a different take on the effect of technology on jobs.
I think that most economists would be quite sceptical about the idea that we're moving into an era of technological unemployment where somehow technological change will kill a lot more jobs than we create. In this country, we are awash with work at the moment. We are creating a lot of jobs in this economy. They're not very productive jobs. But I think in this country, it's hard to make the case that we're running out of work because of the pace of technological change. I just don't see that. So I'm in no sense saying that technology is irrelevant or downplaying it. I'm just saying it's affecting the distribution of work rather than the overall quantity. I think we can be fairly confident that almost under any foreseeable scenario for the next 10, 20 years, we're going to have a very large number of jobs in our economy in low-paying sectors, often called low-skilled jobs. It's a given that we're going to see a big growth in the number of people caring, particularly for the elderly, in our economy. But I think we're going to see a growth in leisure sector, if you like, related jobs, personal services and so on. There have been some quite rapid change in some sectors, but actually the thing that I'm generally struck by is that that change has been slower than I would have thought it had been. I'm kind of surprised we haven't seen more change, given the fact that machines are so much powerful, more powerful than they were 5 years ago, never mind 25 years ago. So in some ways, our economies actually are more sluggish to adapt, I think, to frontier innovations than we might think.
Do you think, for example, the American economy is quicker to adapt?
First of all, I think the American public debate is quicker to pick up in some of these things than the British one. And I think the American public debate tends to be more framed by technologists and futurologists, whereas we tend to be more framed, if you like, by dismal economists. I also think, a different point, that America is just more successful at taking new innovation into kind of relatively mainstream production than we have been in the UK.
If the machines become fantastically cheap, they might change that debate.
Yeah, I've yet to see the machine which is going to cut someone's hair or look after my or your mum. that's kind of where a lot of these jobs are at. Now, maybe one day, but I think that day is an awful long way down the road, and I think there will be a lot of resistance to that.
I wonder if the rest of us, you know, economists, journalists, lawyers, are all going to be rushing for those jobs.
What, to be hairdressers and carers, yeah. I think that's a way off too.
In fact, in Japan, robots are already looking after old people. And Panasonic is experimenting with machines that, if they don't actually cut your hair, at least wash it.
Here the robot is applying shampoo. The shampoo is lathered inside the machine, which means it only needs a small amount to wash the entire head.
And this summer, a hotel opens in Nagasaki, staffed entirely by robots. But even if machines don't move into these areas in the foreseeable future, the advance of technology in the world of work does pose an important question. What is work for? Maybe a lot of it is just killing time. Federico Pistono is looking forward to the time when machines do all the drudgery of work so we can get on with the business of living. The subtitle of his book, Why Robots Will Steal Your Job, is But That's OK. Do you think we need jobs in the future?
I think we need some jobs, but I don't think we need as many jobs as we like to think we do. I think we could accomplish actually far more than we do if we recognize that we should decouple income and employment. I think we are not really planning for society. We are kind of just going along with it and see what happens. So if we really ask ourselves the question, like, what is society for? You know, like, why do we do stuff? We haven't asked ourselves, what is the purpose of, for example, work? I mean, it should be to increase your standard of living so you can do the things you like. You can spend time with your family. It seems to me that we are kind of working for the sake of making money so we can buy stuff. We should have a big public discussion about this topic.
In fact, technology already seems to be decoupling labour and income. Last year, we collectively spent nearly 500 million hours each day updating Facebook. That's 25 times the amount of labour that it took to build the Panama Canal. And we did it all for free. And as thinkers like Thomas Piketty have argued, money seems to be gravitating away from workers to the owners of capital. And today, capital is more and more technology itself. While we were all contributing for free, Facebook made a profit of nearly $3 billion. So what effect will this have on capitalism, which seems to have at its heart the exchange of labour for money? Andrew McAfee again.
I believe the main challenge of that is that most of us get our money to acquire all these delightful goods and services by offering our labour to the economy. And as technology can do more and more, that labour becomes less and less valuable.
David Graeber is Professor of Anthropology at the London School of Economics and widely seen as the intellectual mind behind the Occupy movement. You may have already heard him on the radio this week, deconstructing debt.
I think what happened in the 60s and 70s is that a lot of capitalists thought, oh my God, Marx was right, when Marx said that you could only make profit off human labor. That was his prediction, that gradually technology would make capitalism less and less profitable because you can't actually exploit a machine. Now it's starting to happen. Will capitalism survive? I suspect not. So it strikes me that we are going to move to something else. I am a long-term thinker. And one of my greatest worries is whatever the next thing is going to be even worse. It could be some new form of feudalism or fascism or techno-fascism of some kind. That could easily happen.
This is scary stuff. Our clever advances in technology might be destroying not just jobs, but the possibility of jobs, or certainly jobs that might enable us to make a living. But not everyone is so dystopian. Pippa Malgram was one of George W. Bush's economic advisers and now works as a financial consultant. She thinks technology will save us rather than condemn us to a world ruled by machines. In fact, she likes technology so much, she's set up a robotics company of her own.
A friend of mine said, well, actually, I have this idea about building drones for commercial purposes, things like surveying farmland and surveying buildings and news collection. And I said, fabulous, how wonderful. And so together we collaborated and we created a company, H Robotics.
What kind of work are these drones going to be doing?
Look at property surveyors. Right now, the usual approach is there's a guy on the ground with a pair of expensive binoculars. So now people are going to have a chance to use these drones to fly right up to the top of the building, get very close, have a good look at exactly what's going on.
And won't that put surveyors out of work? Well, no, though they'll have to sharpen their drone flying skills.
You still need a person to fly these things. They're just going to be better equipped with the drone than they are with binoculars. I'm very optimistic about the job-creating capability of new technology. So I think that for every robot you deploy, you actually create jobs. It probably creates something like 3 or 4 jobs for every new machine.
But how do we know they're going to create 4 new jobs for each one?
I think it's literally a range of opinion that's not provable. We probably won't know for another decade. All I know is from my work in the field, what I see is more and more people being hired into companies that are engaged in the creation of robotics. There's just no way to prove it yet. But I think that we're going to find that, like all technological innovation, you end up creating more opportunities ultimately than destroying them.
Okay. So we need more people to build the drones. But once they're up and flying, surely those surveyors that use them will be able to get their work done more quickly, putting other surveyors out of business. There can't be that many buildings to survey. So what will they do when they join the lawyers, doctors and journalists who have found their jobs being taken over by computers? The arts, perhaps?
I think we're all going to innovate and we're all going to change. We're going to learn how to use these machines and make ourselves more productive and more effective. My personal view is that a robot will never be able to engage in creativity. It can just follow an algorithm that a human being has designed and given it. Therefore, it can't make creative leaps. And this is where real innovation comes from the creativity of the human mind. And I just don't think we should underestimate that.
It's a nice idea. While robots are doing all the drudge work, we can be writing novels, putting on plays and composing music. But don't be so sure. This setting, for soprano and piano, of Percy Shelley's poem Mutability, was composed not by a human, but by a computer called Iamus at the University of Malaga. It may not be to everyone's taste, but you know what? I feel I've heard a lot worse. And if a computer can do this now, what will it be capable of in, say, 10 years' time? The challenge for us now is how we can prepare for a world where machines compose music, cut our hair, and who knows, arbitrate our legal disputes. One thing's for sure, we're going to need to change the way we think about education and careers. Those reliable middle-class routes to prosperity, including law and medicine, may not be so lucrative anymore. Lawyer Gregor Pryor.
From a personal perspective, it's been incredibly fun for me to be a lawyer. If we're talking about job security, I'm not sure I would recommend for people to go into the law if their working assumption is that it's a safe, stable, unchallenged environment. I think, like every other aspect of business these days, I don't think there is such a thing as job security in many areas, and I think the law is no different now.
What would you recommend parents to send their kids into?
MIT followed by some kind of incubator or startup, probably. I mean, that's where the real money is these days.
And for those of us who might not quite make the grade for MIT, Andrew McAfee, who was one of the first to warn of this job-destroying nature of today's technology, thinks it's time to bring back the fun into education.
Like you can imagine, we get asked this question about how should I prepare my children all the time. So when I talk to parents of young children and they say, what trajectory do we put our kids on? The advice I give is to send them off to some, I went to a Montessori school, send them off to some fairly open kind of hippie flavor of education that teaches them that the world is a really interesting place. And their job is to go poke at it, try to understand it better, just kind of play around in the world.
But perhaps the most radical suggestion comes from Pippa Malgren. She wants us to go back to the workshop.
What we really need to do is to put what we Americans call shop class or you might call vocational training, back into schools. That's when you're 12, 13, 14 years old and you learn how to weld metal, how to sew, how to make an engine go. You know how plumbing actually operates. We've had 20 or 30 years of a software revolution with silicon chips and the capacity of computers to do more and more. But what we're getting now is a hardware revolution. I think now that I'm in the robotics business, I would rather hire an 18-year-old who spent the last 3 or 4 years welding metal and playing with engines than I would hire somebody with a business degree. No question about it. But it's hard to find kids who've been allowed that experience.
Which opens up an interesting possibility. Maybe these 18-year-olds, thin on the ground, might demand a higher wage than all those MBAs coming out of business school. Perhaps this new wave of technology will at last provide opportunities for manual labourers who that first wave of robots put out of work, at least if they know how to program a computer.
I think another thing is that you have to actually learn how to do computer coding if you want to be conversant in the world economy today. And finally, maybe the most important thing is to change our whole attitude to work and the workplace. We're going to have multiple careers, multiple endeavors, multiple skill sets, lifelong education. And the key thing is we all have to be ready and have a willingness to say yes to the change when it touches our lives. I sometimes have, you know, young people come see me and ask whether they should take a job at a big financial institution in the city or in Wall Street where they have security, or should they go to work for a small company? And I'm like, what makes you think you have any security working for a big bank in the city or a big company? Big companies don't provide security. That era is over.
My old man was a good old man, skilled in the molding trade.
New technology has always put people out of work. In a way, that's its point. And it's always caused pain when it does. It hurts to imagine that even part of what we do for work could be done better by a machine. But in the past, technology has always held out the prospect, at least, of some new role in the world of work, a new skill to learn, a new job to do, a new way of earning a living. That doesn't feel so true anymore, because technology now has got very, very good indeed. And the speed it's improving has become almost supersonic. It's hard to peer into this hyper-technological future with much certainty. 10 years ago, we couldn't have imagined we'd all have little supercomputers in our pockets. 20 years ago, we couldn't have imagined Facebook. But one thing is for sure. Technology won't stop its advance. The only question is, where is it going to strike next?
Watch out for the man with the silicon chip. Hold on to your job with a good firm grip. 'Cause if you don't, you'll have had your chips the same as my old man.
Analysis was produced by Charlotte MacDonald. Next week on Analysis, anthropologist Professor Henrietta Moore argues that the concept of development has outlived its usefulness.